It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Another mass kidnapping in Nigeria, a warning about the costs of environmental crime in Africa. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Suspected Islamist militants carried out another mass kidnapping in Nigeria's northeast Borno state, the same region where more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted by Boko Haram in April. Local officials and residents said Tuesday gunmen seized dozens of women and girls and possibly more than 30 boys in raids on several villages about 100 kilometers from Maiduguri, the state capital. Meanwhile, at least 18 people have been killed in retaliatory clashes between Christians and Muslims in Central African Republic. Witnesses and security officials said the violence began Monday near the central town of Bambari, continued into Tuesday. At the same time, the International Federation for Human Rights warned that it's found evidence of crimes, including extrajudicial executions, rape and the recruitment of child soldiers in recent fact-finding missions in CAR involving both mostly Muslim Salika rebels and Christian anti-Balaka militia. In Kenya, attackers armed with machetes killed at least 5 people near the coastal town of Witu in the Katete region late Monday. Somali-based Al-Shabaab militants say they were behind attacks in nearby villages last week that killed some 65 people. In Nairobi, the first UN Environment Assembly meeting discussed crimes such as poaching and the selling of illegal charcoal to finance criminal, militia, and terror groups. Christian Nelleman heads the Rapid Response Assessment of the UN Environmental Program.
In Africa alone, we believe the governments are losing revenues for at least $1.9 billion a year. Secondly, we also believe that due to the involvement of organized crime in the entire charcoal trade, we believe that people organized in this are probably making even more than the government would from revenues in the scale of $2 to $9 billion a year. This is equivalent up to 3 times the value of the drug trade in Africa.
The report says Al-Shabaab makes up to $56 million a year in illegal charcoal, with the illegal trade in natural resources such as logging, mushrooming in recent years, threatening species and ecosystems. Meanwhile, a rights organization says thousands of people in the Kenyan port city Mombasa face serious health problems from toxic lead at a former battery recycling center. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Sticking in Nairobi, Human Rights Watch senior environment researcher Jane Cohen says a whole community is under threat because Kenyan authorities have not acted to enforce the law.
It should not go unnoticed that not very far from Nairobi, there is a situation in Owino Uhuru community, which is a tragic example of what happens when economic development is unregulated.
At issue is a battery recycling plant that opened in 2007. The New York-based Human Rights Watch says the plant closed its operations earlier this year and moved elsewhere. But the lead remains in the community and needs to be cleaned up by the government swiftly. Human Rights Watch says a government investigation in 2009 found the battery plant had violated regulations. Former plant workers said they had no protective clothing or gear to deal with the poisonous lead. Human Rights Watch notes Kenya has strong environmental laws to protect its citizens, but they need enforcement. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Sudanese foreign ministry official denies reports a Christian woman accused of apostasy was rearrested a day after an appeals court Monday ordered her release from prison. He said officials took Maryam Ibrahim to an undisclosed location to protect her from relatives angered by the court's decision. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf said U.S. officials received word Ms. Ibrahim had been released but could not confirm if the family had left the country.
The family was temporarily detained at the airport for several hours by the government for questioning over issues related to their travel and, I think, travel documents. They have not been arrested. The government has assured us of their safety. The embassy has been and will remain highly involved in working with the family and the government. We are engaging directly with Sudanese officials to secure their safe and swift departure from Sudan. And, of course, we'll provide more information as we get it.
In May, Ms. Ibrahim was sentenced to death by hanging under a conviction of apostasy for refusing to abandon her Christian faith. The world's biggest platinum producers Tuesday signed a wage agreement with the union representing thousands of workers, ending a 5-month strike. The company's lawman Anglo-American and Impala warned, however, there were no winners and restructuring and job cuts may be inevitable.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan denies it rearrested a Christian woman whose conviction for apostasy had been annulled by an Islamic court.
From point of government, we have no any sort of thing against her. She can travel anytime. Maybe her traveling documents are not completed, something like that. But she is not arrested.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. A medical aid group says that West Africa's Ebola epidemic is out of control. Libyans are voting today for a new parliament amid security concerns. Kenya's government questions an opposition demand for dialogue, and workers praised agreement that ended South Africa's longest strike.
We've managed to unshackle ourselves from this slave wage structure that came long from colonialization to the last 20 years of our democracy that hasn't been challenged.
Joseph Matunjua is president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa. And commemorating the 50th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Civil Rights Act. Those stories plus Mark Oldman, Sports and Our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's Minister of Information says his government did not rearrest or detain Mariam Yahya Ibrahim, the Christian woman whose death sentence for apostasy was cancelled by an Islamic court on Monday. Ibrahim's lawyer said she and her husband were rearrested at the airport on Tuesday by Sudanese security as they tried to board a plane. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal tells me it's possible Ibrahim and her husband might have had some issues with their travel documents, but they were never arrested.
Actually, from the very beginning, it was not a problem of the government. It is a judicial problem. She was being to court by a complaint from her family. And the process from the higher court now is being freed. And she went home. And today, I'm not quite sure what's happening, but maybe her release should be completed from other things. But from point of government, we have no any sort of thing against her. She can travel anytime. She is not arrested. Maybe her traveling documents are not completed, something like that. But she is not arrested.
Now, she is also claiming that maybe her life is in danger. Would you understand why she would say that her life is in danger?
She will be protected by the government. She will be protected because the family are against her and so forth. But from our side, we are going to protect her and nothing will happen to her or to her baby or her husband.
Minister, a United Nations expert is calling on your government to release all political prisoners and allow for press freedom if you are to show that your government is really committed towards the national dialogue.
Absolutely. We are very much committed to the national dialogue. We have no political prisoners. This is being arrested according to also crimes against the national security, not because from the political point of view. Like Sadiq al-Mahdi, they, after investigations and these things, and they will be presented to court, and they are going to be free. We have no political prisoner whatsoever.
So what about this Mr. Badarin Sheikh?
This is actually, maybe he committed the same thing as Sadiq al-Mahdi. He has been talking about the security, about the army, and these things, and he's going also to court. And not because of his opinion or political opinion.
So what about the allegations that newspapers in Sudan continue to be subject to censorship?
I'm the Minister of Information. I will assure you that there is nothing like this happening. We have only one newspaper being now stopped, and in very few days it will resume again.
So there's no censorship in the country?
No censorship before or after, and we have no one actually prevented from writing. Any writer can write his opinion.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. He spoke with me from the capital, Khartoum. Libyans head to the polls today, Wednesday, for their second parliamentary elections since the 2011 toppling of leader Muammar Gaddafi. VOA's Elizabeth Arad has more from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Few Libyans are expected to participate in Wednesday's vote for a new parliament. Only a quarter of the population is registered to take part. and the fear of violence may keep many of those away from the polls. The central government holds little influence beyond the capital, Tripoli, making security precautions tenuous. UN official Ismail Ould Sheikh says the United Nations is trying to help with the vote.
There are still political and security obstacles, and our operation may face these obstacles. The road forward is not going to be easy, and for that reason, the United Nations continues to provide support under a mandate from the Security Council.
Forces loyal to renegade General Khalifa Haftar engage in near daily battle with Islamist militants in Libya's east. Haftar, who for years enjoyed U.S. protection, has promised a ceasefire during the vote. But rival militias, many armed by NATO forces during the 2011 uprising, continue to cause unrest across the nation. Still, the head of Libya's election commission remained hopeful the vote would proceed smoothly.
Regarding our arrangements in Benghazi, they're going to plan. In the south, we have no problems regarding the electoral process. Any security problems have no direct link to the electoral process.
And some voters hold out hope the election will help shore up the power of the central government.
God willing, this election will go according to plan, and we expect that after everything that has happened recently, we will reach the foundation stage and people will start to move forward and the country will calm down, because the people are really tired of what's going on.
Observers caution counting ballots and forming a government after this party list free election may take some time. More worrisome, they add, is which, if any, of the warring parties will recognize the outcome. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is out of control and that much needs to be done to isolate those suspected of being infected. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Doctors Without Borders says hundreds of Ebola cases have been identified in more than 60 locations in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Several hundred people have died. The group, also known by its French acronym MSF, warns there's a real risk the disease could spread to new areas. It says it's having difficulty responding to the large number of new cases emerging in different locations. Hilde de Klerk is an MSF doctor.
It's an epidemic that is very much dispersed, geographically dispersed. And it's mainly the geographical dispersion that makes it very tough to intervene and to control the outbreak.
She says MSF has a few theories about why Ebola has spread so easily. One is that people move a lot during disease outbreaks, searching for health care or trying to visit family members.
Ebola is a disease that has quite a long incubation time, so meaning the moment when someone gets infected up to the moment that someone falls sick can be rather long, up to 3 weeks. We see that people would move from the forest area all the way down to Conakry, which is 600 kilometers, which is rather far. And then they would only fall sick once they arrive in another place. So that's one of the reasons we think the epidemic is spreading so easily.
Another reason, de Klerk says, is that Ebola is very contagious after its incubation period ends. Its first symptoms may be a fever or flu-like conditions.
It's a disease that is spread person to person, so a person can infect himself by being in direct physical contact with a person infected by Ebola. And people seem to have very vast social networks. So if someone falls sick, it's not just one person caring for the sick person. It's many people. It would be neighbors, sisters, the mother, the father.
Funerals also have the potential to spread Ebola, with large gatherings and people touching or kissing the deceased. Dr. de Klerk says fear of the disease can cause people to take precautions, flee and hide, or even chase people away from their villages. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's Wednesday morning, June 25th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on Diamond FM in Tamale, Ghana. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa has described the agreement which ended the country's longest strike as a breakthrough for workers. Joseph Matunjua says the workers have managed to unshackle themselves from the slave wage structure dating back from colonial times and lasting through 20 years since the end of apartheid. Matunjua tells me the agreement has put the workers on the right path towards decent wages and working conditions in the mining industry.
It was an agreement that we reached for the duration of 3 years, starting from 2013 to 2016, June, of which it gave the least paid mine worker R1,000 increase for each and every month. The lowest paid mine worker in South Africa in platinum sector was 4,500 a month. So therefore, it was quite a very slave salary, considering the environment of which our members are subjected into. I think it's a journey that one has to walk until such time that our members realize better working condition and decent salary.
So would you say that this was a victory for the workers?
I would say this was a breakthrough. We've managed to unshackle ourselves from this slave wage structure that came long from colonialization to the National Party to the last 20 years of our democracy that hasn't been challenged. So it's a breakthrough. We are in the right path towards decent salary, decent working condition in the mining industry.
Do you think there could be some consequences for this long strike, meaning that the companies might want to dismiss some workers?
You know, capitalism is driven by profit. Workers are retrenched even if there's no strike, or if the commodity is not sellable or doesn't make profit. So the issue of retrenchment is inevitable. But I don't think these employers will be so stupid that coming from a 5 month strike, they could embark on restructuring, because we will never fold our hands and look at the employers exploiting our members.
You mentioned the colonial era and the impact on today's workers in South Africa. There have been too many strikes in South Africa. Do you think it's time for the employers, the companies, to rethink their policies?
I think it is proper that they should look at these neoliberal policies that doesn't address the inequalities that was created more than 300 years ago. Even in our dispensation from 1994, the pay structure that was designed for black mine workers, it was never challenged and it was never changed. So therefore, it is incumbent to the government to look at the trade policies, industrialization policies, and economic policies of the country to see to it that it doesn't create poverty or subject the nation into poverty.
Joseph Matunjua is president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg. Kenya's presidential spokesman is questioning a demand by former prime minister and main opposition leader Raila Odinga for a dialogue with President Uhuru Kenyatta's government by July 7th. Odinga also wants the administration to come up with a timetable for the withdrawal of Kenyan troops from neighboring Somalia, where soldiers have been battling the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. Manua Isipitu tells reporter Peter Clotty Mr. Odinga's demands are well outside the country's constitution.
It's one of those demands that one looks at and wonders why there should be any demands in the first place. The country only agreed to a new constitution 4 years ago. Most aspects of this constitution came into effect with the elections of last year, the elections that brought President Uhuru Kenyatta to office, and elections in which Mr. Odinga lost. So the fact is that we have a constitution, and that constitution has institutions that guarantee various forms of redress to any issues that might be affecting our society. So we do believe that we are not in a position where Mr. Odinga could be asking for a forum outside of those ones that are allocated within the Constitution.
But some people are saying that it is good for him to ask for a dialogue, especially with the security and other challenges that the country faces at the moment. So they think it's justified for him to make such gesture to the administration as part of a unified measure.
Well, to ask to participate in seeking solutions to a country's problems is welcome. Obviously, as many ideas that are useful that we can take on board, the better. But you can't then be making demands of those things and giving deadlines. I mean, if you want to be taken seriously, if you want to be part of the inclusive nature of a dialogue that leads to something, then you cannot be attempting to force that dialogue to happen. I think you've got to be respectful about it. You've got to be civil about it.
Some people have expressed concern that the recent attacks should be investigated and prosecuted because some leaders in the community are inciting the others to enable the youth to clash among themselves and worsening the security situation in parts of the country. How is the government handling these issues?
Investigations are underway in areas where this has happened. I think our government is does take these things very seriously. We have, in Lamu, for instance, we have sent hundreds of police reinforcements to comb the area, bring perpetrators of this violence to justice. We have, in quite a few instances, our Director of Public Prosecutions has asked quite a number of politicians to report to police to record statements about the recent speeches that are considered hate speech or hate mongering. And I think those that are found to be guilty of these offences will be dealt with in terms of the law.
Manua Isipisu is Kenya's presidential spokesman. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. A milestone in American history is being remembered this week as the nation marks the 50th anniversary of the signing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act on July 2, 1964. The landmark federal legislation outlawed racial discrimination and ended segregation in schools, the workplace, and at public accommodations. VOA's Chris Simpkins takes a look at the steps that led to passage of the Civil Rights Act, which marked a turning point in American history.
1963, Birmingham, Alabama. Civil rights demonstrations in the U.S. South turn violent. President John Kennedy calls the situation a moral crisis.
This is not a sectional issue. Difficulties over segregation and discrimination exist in every city, in every state of the Union, producing in many cities a rising tide of discontent that threatens the public safety.
President Kennedy meets civil rights leader Martin Luther King to discuss ending the demonstrations. The meeting is arranged by Kennedy advisor Harris Wofford.
King deliberately said part of what nonviolent direct action does is it creates a crisis that people in power, whether it's government or a corporation or others, they have to listen to.
President Kennedy responds in a nationally televised address.
But in too many communities, in too many parts of the country, wrongs are inflicted on Negro citizens, and there are no remedies at law. Unless the Congress acts, their only remedy is the street. I am therefore asking the Congress to enact legislation giving all Americans the right to be served in facilities which are open to the public.
The Civil Rights Act outlaws racial segregation in schools, the workplace, and at public accommodations such as restaurants. The legislation faces strong opposition from mostly white Southern lawmakers who tried to block its passage. Harris Wofford says the ongoing demonstrations and President Kennedy's assassination created the conditions for passing the Civil Rights Act.
I don't think it would necessarily have passed if he hadn't been killed, and a wave of sympathy and understanding swept the majority of the people in the United States.
July 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act into law. Former Congressman Ron Dellum says it is a crowning achievement for so many African Americans.
The Civil Rights Act was a very significant event in American history. I maintain it was a time when the people in this country actually bent the political process to their will.
Activists say the support of so many who demonstrated for freedom and justice in the 1960s helped make the Civil Rights Act a reality and a cornerstone of racial justice. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Colombia outclassed Japan 4-1 in Cuiabá as Greece pipped Ivory Coast 2-1 in Fortaleza in the final Group C encounter on Tuesday. As a result, Colombia topped the group, and with Greece will advance to the knockout phase, while third-placed Ivory Coast and fourth-placed Japan are eliminated from the contest. This is the first time Greece has qualified for the knockout phase at the World Cup. Elsewhere, Uruguay edged a 10-man Italy by a solitary goal in Natal. England salvaged a measure of national pride when they held group leaders Costa Rica to a scoreless draw in Belo Horizonte. Consequently, Costa Rica topped the group and with second-placed Uruguay progressed to the knockout phase of the competition, while third-placed Italy and bottom-of-the-table England head home. Meanwhile, Italy's coach Cesare Prandelli resigned immediately after Italy failed to qualify for the second round at the World Cup. He vigorously protests against the sending off of midfielder Claudio Marchisio, which he reckons weakened Italy to the point which led to their defeat against Uruguay. In a similar vein, Sabri Lamouchi has resigned following Ivory Coast's failure to advance to the second round at the World Cup. Staying in Brazil, African champions Nigeria play Argentina in Porto Alegre as Bosnia-Herzegovina face Iran in Salvador in the final Group E matches today, Wednesday. Elsewhere in Group F, Honduras plays Switzerland in the Amazon rainforest city of Manaus as Ecuador face France in Rio de Janeiro. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, June 25th.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa, and listeners across the world. I wish to use your medium to tell the Nigerian armies that the reason why Nigerians are saying that there's gross conspiracy in the fight against the Islamic extremist Boko Haram over the Chibok girls abduction is because the same route the Nigerian army normally mount roadblocks is the same road these boys who do come out of their kingdom and terrorize innocent Nigerians just to condemn Goodluck Ebele Jonathan's administration. Albert Alagbo, former Budukato Ranch Bechivan Ward in Obanuku local government area of Crossroads State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Wednesday, June 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, as well as post-editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barter saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.